From National Public Radio, it's Latino USA.
You must open the market, open the land, trying to increase the market. And the increasing market maybe is able to obtain more products.
Free market capitalism. Sounds familiar? Maybe so here at home. But in Cuba, it's the voice of change.
I'm a member of the co-op. I sell to them and sell to the private market as well. But I decide what to plant, not the co-op.
Today on the program, Cuba's new direction after Fidel and the Nueva Trova sounds of Cuban expatriate Alex Cuba. Coming up on Latino USA, I'm Maria Hinojosa. Stay with us. Immigration policy and the Cuban embargo are among the issues that Pope Benedict spoke with President Bush about during the Pontiff's six-day U.S. visit. Joining us to discuss this and other news of the week affecting the Latino community is Maria Elena Salinas, national news anchor for Univision. Hey, Maria Elena.
Hi, Maria.
I know you're very interested in this story. Univision has been covering a lot, but let's talk specifically about what were the salient points that we need to know about what the Pope said to President Bush regarding Latinos and Latino issues.
Well, you know, the Vatican has been very aware of the importance of Latinos in the Catholic Church in the United States since before his trip. That is why it's no surprise that when he sent his message before embarking on this trip, his message was both in Spanish and in English. And he has mentioned in the past the importance of immigration, but he did take advantage of the fact that he had that kind of an audience, that he was with President Bush, and immigration was one of the very delicate issues that he discussed with him. Basically, he's asking for, you know, humane treatment of immigrants. He's not necessarily asking to change the laws, but to take these immigrants into consideration, and it should not be any surprise. The relationship between Latinos and the Catholic Church in the United States is very important. In the U.S., they're one-third of the Catholic Church, even though they're only 14% of the population.
So while the Pope is talking to President Bush about humane treatment for Latino immigrants, another story that was happening this week is federal officials investigating complaints of the opposite of what would be humane treatment of immigrants, which it would be racial profiling by an Arizona sheriff. What's the story here, Marilena?
These are complaints that are specifically coming from Phoenix Mayor Phil Gordon complaining about Culpeper County Sheriff Joe Arpaio. You know, he's very hardline, and he has basically created some kind of a posse to go after undocumented immigrants besides his deputies. According to this letter that the mayor wrote, the sheriff and his deputies are violating the civil rights of residents by racial profiling. He specifically called it discriminatory harassment, improper stops and searches. And this, Maria, is a very delicate situation because Arizona is so divided on this issue. And there's a lot of people, frankly, that do support what the sheriff is doing. You know, Mayor Gordon is not alone. He also has the support of the Arizona Ecumenical Council, the Anti-Defamation League, but there's no telling what's going to come out of this because it was the federal government who asked local law enforcement to play the role of immigration agents, and unfortunately, these are some of the consequences that we see.
Exactly. Okay, Maria Elena, which is a good way to segue into several ICE raids on food processing plants from the company Pilgrim's Pride. Now, this is a huge food company. Tell us what happened about this raid, why it's important, and where these raids happened.
Yeah, this is one of the biggest poultry companies in the country. It's ironic because these raids happened on this very same day when Pope Benedict XVI was meeting with President Bush and talking about humane treatment for undocumented immigrants. And here you have these raids of what ICE is calling foreign nationals that are suspected of committing identity theft and other criminal violations to obtain their job. And basically what you're talking about is people who use false ID cards or false Social Security cards. They were mostly in five states, in Texas, Florida, Tennessee, Arkansas, and West Virginia, which is only where some of the factories are for Pilgrim's Pride. It's mostly the workers that were detained, that would be about 400 of them, and what the upper management is saying, we are not involved, we did not hire anyone who is here illegally, knowingly. There have been no civil or criminal charges made against the company itself. According to the information, the defendants that are accused and found guilty could face up to 5 years in federal prison, but there's no talk yet of deportations, which is what usually happens when some of these people are rounded up.
And Marielena, you and I, who have been in many of those poultry plants, not necessarily Pilgrim's Pride ones, but it's hard to believe that the management doesn't know when 80% of its staff is Latino and speaking Spanish, who are working for them, and they're working for them right in their own companies. Okay.
Right, and when the company says we are cooperating, I guess they're basically trying to clean up their act, and they're trying to protect themselves at the risk of hurting these little people that they many times take advantage of and make them work long hours and not paying them what they deserve to be paid. It's a shame that they're not taking the responsibility that they should be taking for these types of things.
Okay, Marielena, we'll certainly be watching it. Thanks for joining us.
Okay, Maria, take care.
Marielena Salinas is a syndicated columnist and national news anchor for Univision, the Spanish language television network. It's Latino USA. I'm Maria Hinojosa. Today, gas prices are unbelievable, and even basic groceries leave a dent in your pocketbook. But for most of us here in the United States, at least there is food on the shelves of the grocery stores. Globally, there simply is not enough food to go around. The president of the World Bank recently stated that skyrocketing food prices will likely lead to violence and upheaval in many countries. In nearby Cuba, new president Raúl Castro is seeking to make chronic food shortages a thing of the past. And he's introducing reforms to the socialist agriculture industry. From Havana, contributor Reese Ehrlich sent this report on Cuba's new efforts to feed its people.
In theory, everyone in Cuba gets an adequate amount of food each day. But getting that food, to borrow a Cuban phrase, es muy complicado. Every Cuban receives a ration card to shop at government stores like this one on a Havana street corner. It sells staples such as milk, rice, and beans at cheap, government-subsidized prices. The government says it provides children with 1 liter of milk a day at an affordable price. But in practice, these stores often run out of products. At a nearby kiosk, Cubans can buy fresh items such as plantains, bananas, yuca, and papaya. That's an improvement over years past when such items were in short supply because of over-reliance on state farms. But the prices at these free market stalls can be very high. This shopper complains that the pork roast costs about 1/6 of her monthly wage. So the Cuban government is trying to increase food production and lower prices. The Cuban government is relying less on large-scale farms and more on Cuba's 250,000 small farms and cooperatives. Outside the central Cuban city of Sancti Spiritus, Humberto Hernandez walks around his 2-acre farm, showing off his plantains, coffee trees, and dairy cattle.
I'm a member of the co-op. I sell to them and sell to the private market as well. But I decide what to plant, not the co-op.
Raúl Ruiz, a Ministry of Agriculture official, says small farms have proven to be more productive in many cases than large state-owned farms. He cites the example of successful urban farms growing vegetables and raising pigs.
And persons are able to produce in a small place a big quantity of its stuff. But the results are that practically they are owner of this production, and the salaries and the benefits are very high. And this is good for the person who is producing, for the customer too, because the product is fresh, the prices are lower.
That might seem obvious in a capitalist economy or even in socialist China, but for Cuba, it's a major breakthrough. For years, Cuba sought technical solutions, such as eradicating disease and improving crop production in the large state farms. But Hernandez says maybe that wasn't the problem.
Maybe it is a social problem, a political problem. You must open the market, open the land. The land is exploitation. Maybe open the way in which the person are able to buy seeds, to buy products, to buy animals, trying to increase the market. And the increasing market maybe is able to obtain more products.
The Cuban state owns most of the farmland, and now the goal is to lease out fallow land to small farmers. But problems still remain. Even privately owned farms can't be bought and sold. This prevents land speculation, but it also means farmers can only pass their farms on to relatives after they die or trade them for another farm. I asked 76-year-old Hernandez what happens when he passes away.
Es imposible, si vienen los ayudan, pero es imposible, porque trabajan con el Estado. Consideramos que ellas se queden con esto y buscarán la manera.
My two children don't want the farm. They have good jobs working for the government. So the farm will go to my grandson. He's 11 and shows a lot of interest. Some people would like to sell their land. I think it's a good idea. There might be other farmers who want to buy.
La ganancia esa de usted me compra y el otro.
In order to significantly increase food production, Cuban officials say the island needs greater foreign investment. Since 2000, the U.S. has sold food to Cuba and has become its largest supplier of agricultural products. But the U.S. economic embargo requires Cuba to pay cash in advance and prohibits most other kinds of trade. Even with all of these new economic reforms, agricultural ministry official Santiago Yanez says the embargo hurts Cuba's food supply.
Estamos mucho más cerca de Estados Unidos para comprar productos y limitaríamos muchísimo también todo lo que se paga por flete en barcos que vienen a distancias muy lejos.
We're much closer to the U.S. and should be able to buy products, but we are restricted in what can be shipped. We have to trade with countries very far away. Cuban products could easily ship to the U.S. The U.S. could invest here.
Sucesivamente, hay veces Cuba hace una inversión de un producto determinado.
Cubans hope that a future U.S. administration will lift or at least modify the trade embargo. Meanwhile, President Raul Castro has called for wide-ranging debate about economic reform. For Latino USA, I'm Reese Ehrlich, reporting from Havana.
Today, 1.5 million Cubans live in the United States, most fully assimilated into American life. Cuban immigrants have often been perceived as political refugees opposed to Fidel Castro. But the reality is more nuanced, with younger, more recent arrivals changing attitudes within the Cuban-American community. One such immigrant is Moraima Crespo. She emigrated from Cuba last year and now lives in Chicago. Bienvenida al programa, Moraima.
Ah, gracias a ti, María.
Moraima, there's a sense that somehow it's easier for Cubans to leave their country to get to the United States, that somehow the voyage is easier. It can be dangerous, but there is a perception that that's the way it is and that other immigrants have a much more difficult time. But in fact, what is your story and what do you know about other Cubans who are leaving the island?
Yo creo que mi experiencia no fue muy riesgosa porque tuve la oportunidad de que
I think that my own experience wasn't all that dangerous. There was a family in Mexico that invited me to their country, which is what you need to get an exit visa. Once in Mexico, I had a friend that went with me to the U.S. border, and I was able to cross. But I know a lot of people that went through far worse. My cousin just came to the U.S. a month ago in a small boat. She tried four times to leave the island in one of those little rafts. Two times she was arrested in Cuba. She finally made it. But she risked a lot because it was so dangerous.
So would you say, Moraima, that your decision to leave Cuba is a political statement, that you left because you had problems with the government of Fidel Castro, that you is the only government that you knew? Or is there something else going on? And what about, you know, the people who you know who have left?
Yo nunca había pensado irme de mi país. Yo estudié en la universidad, hice mi carrera, hice mi
I never thought I would leave my country. I went to college, started a career. I had a lot of faith in the system, and I never had any problems with the government. But it was a process, that over time you start to realize that your goals and dreams are never met. I had a lot of hope when I was young, but once I started working, I realized it was a waste of time.
So we just heard a report of reforms being implemented by Raúl Castro in agriculture. So your father is a farmer who is still living in Cuba, in Pinar del Río. What are you hearing in terms of these reforms? Are they good? Are people excited? Or is it just, you know, another political ploy?
Mira, María, yo te voy a decir sinceramente, desde que yo salí de Cuba,
Well, Maria, I can tell you that since I left Cuba, I've spoken with my father several times, but honestly, neither one of us feels comfortable talking about what he really thinks about the changes in Cuba, because I still think the government is controlling information, the telephones, mail, and so we really haven't had a deep conversation like we would have if I was still in Cuba.
So, Moraima, would you say that you are happy living in Chicago, happier than Havana and Pinar del Río, or just settled?
Yo estoy feliz. Porque hay muchísimos momentos en que yo he experimentado que yo me siento libre.
I am happy. I've had a lot of moments where I really just feel free. And really, that was what I wanted. And even though a lot is changing in Cuba, I can't help but feel things remain the same. They say there is a debate now, but I just think there is a sterility to life in Cuba. And I don't want that for my life. And in Cuba, there's so much effort put into controlling everything that it's really just absurd.
Moraima, thank you so much for joining us on Latino USA, and I'm so happy that you feel free and happy. That's wonderful.
Okay, you're welcome.
And now, permítame que les cuente algo un poco más personal. I've talked about this issue before, perhaps because it's become a part of our lives. Fear. Fear is the issue. When I was in Havana, I felt no fear at all. But I had been told that more than likely, places where I went and stayed may have been bugged. I was staying with an American family living in Havana. It must be pretty nasty, I thought, to know that you're being listened to by government officials. But in the United States, I have no guarantee that my line hasn't been tapped. Other journalists allege they may have been. I just have to wonder, instead of my friend in Havana, who knew it was happening. So, fast forward to me at the Montego Bay Airport, Sunday night, on my way back from Havana, and my palms are sweating. I had come upon the news that Michael Moore was being hassled in the United States because he had traveled to Cuba allegedly unauthorized. He was being threatened with detention, I had even heard. And here I was, traveling back from Havana. I went into a state of panic. I imagined seeing myself detained at Kennedy Airport, taken into a basement office by the Department of Homeland Security where I wouldn't be able to call my husband and kids, and something horrible was going to happen to me because I had just gone to Havana. From the Montego Bay Airport, I got through to Michael Ratner, the president of the Center for Constitutional Rights, and he told me that as a journalist, I had every right to travel to Cuba under the law as it is written. He said I also had the right to not answer any of the Department of Homeland Security or immigration officials' questions without a lawyer. I was relieved but still anxious on the plane ride back. But guess what? Did the immigration official even look at my passport, if barely my face, when I arrived into John F. Kennedy Airport? This is the person who barely even noticed me, but it's a person that's supposed to be protecting everyone from terrorists coming into this country? The truth is, we all live in fear, and it's a fear kept alive by our respective governments, which supposedly couldn't be more different. In a minute, El sonido cubano-canadiense, the Cuban-Canadian connection, and the music of Alex Cuba, coming up on Latino USA. Don't go away. You're listening to Latino USA. I'm Maria Hinojosa. When Alexis Puentes visits his homeland of Cuba, he often gets mistaken for being an American or a Canadian tourist. He proudly sports a large afro with long mutton chops, and he loves skin-tight bell-bottoms, not your typical Cuban attire.
Este brillo en los ojos, como el agua más clara, es la humilde mirada sincera callada de alguien que te ama.
But for Alexis, better known as Alex Cuba, his patria, or his fatherland, is always in his heart and his music.
En Artemisa, la tierra que me ha dado la sonrisa, no te hace falta ser inteligente para bailar el son con su montuno sabroso. Dice la gente, allí hay un bongocero diferente que se rompe las manos porque siente.
Alex Cuba is one of an increasing number of Cuban musicians who have emigrated to Canada in recent years, and the growing Canadian-Cuban connection is helping to redefine cultural creativity in both countries. We're very pleased to be joined now by Alex Cuba from Calgary in Canada. Welcome to Latino USA, Alex.
Oh, thank you. It's a real pleasure for me to be here.
So here's the crazy thing about it. You're actually the third Canadian Latino artist that we've interviewed on our program recently. And I think a lot of listeners would probably be surprised to learn that Canada is really becoming, you know, this hot spot for Latin music. So why Canada? Why is it a hot spot? Why now?
Well, we all came to Ghana, whoever is coming, you know, still, whatever, for different reasons. In my case, I was following my woman, you know, the woman that I loved. Fell in love with the country, and the country allowed me to do what I do, and I don't know, it seems to be working for me. It seems to be, it's one of those things that, you know, that you take a turn in life without thinking too much, and then it turns out great, you know what I'm saying?
Sí.
So let's talk for a moment about the different elements that come through in your music. For me, again, a lot of recuerdos, memories of the Nueva Trova movement from Cuba. But you also have on this album a lot of talk about the influence of the orishas on you and on your music. The orishas, which are the representatives of the spiritual kind of saintly representatives of the Yoruba African tradition in Cuba. In fact, Fiesta de Religión is a great song on your CD that talks about the orishas, in particular El Egua. You have your guitar there, Alex. Can you play a little bit of it for us?
Sure.
Fui a una fiesta de religión donde se hablan las verdades, tratando de adivinar de dónde vienen mis pesares y a preguntar si un día colocaría poquito a poco alcance en cumplimiento mis ilusiones. Con mi chalaleo, con mi chalaleo, dando vueltas y más vueltas en este mundo en su apogeo. Caliente. Con mi chalaleo, con mi chalaleo. Un señor que se brindó a desafiar mis ansiedades, con su alegua y su changó, luciendo al pecho mil collares. Preguntó sobre la estera si alguna estrella me alumbraría, y leyó los caracoles como poesía. Tienes, dijo, problemas porque se enredan tus fantasías, buscando otro camino que bobería. Suena como tú quieras, siempre que sea del corazón, que se nos equivoca. Con mi chalaleo, con mi chalaleo, dando vueltas y más vueltas en este mundo en su apogeo. Con mi chalaleo, con mi chalaleo.
Oh, I love it. I love it. It's great because if you speak Spanish, you get to kind of follow the story of somebody going to get a reading from a santero. And then, you know, the line is that you mix up your fantasy with reality, eh? Así es, Alex?
Mm-hmm, yeah. Well, the Orichas were very present, you know, in my life from the beginning. It comes from my grandparents. Yeah, it's been a big part of my life, always. And the way it translates to me today, you know, it's like everybody needs to believe in something in order to remain together, you know, as a person, as you know, the integrity of a person. We either believe, you know, whatever you want to believe, but we all need to believe in something.
Let's talk for a second about another song, Tu Boca Loquita, which translates into Your Mouth Takes Away Essentially My Memories. It's a rocking, kind of ska-influenced song, yet it's still very much in that Cuban tradition of singing to the beauty of a woman.
Yeah, you know what? The way I write music, sometimes it becomes so challenging for me when somebody asks me, oh, can you say something about the song? Can you tell me the story behind the song? Because it is, you know, creativity and inspiration, I guess. It comes really, really from a higher source of whatever it is, you know? Sometimes I'm not even thinking, you know, about something, and all of a sudden an idea for a song hits me, you know. And it's, many times it's like somebody's dictating the song in my ear.
Tiene los labios más lindos, más suaves, más tibios, más rojos, más finos que he visto en la vida.
So, Alex, what would you say that you learned as a musician, as a singer, as a composer, from the new song movement, the Nueva Trova movement of Cuba?
It wasn't seen together, those two things, up until the great Juan Luis Guerra shows up and start making dance music with unbelievable poetry, right? Music with some such beautiful poetry that you could choose on the spot to listen to it and enjoy so much, even when you want to dance, you know what I'm saying? So that's what I'm trying to do. I think that's one of my approaches in music, you know, trying to do something that lyrically means something, but musically is also strong.
Thank you so much for joining us on Latino USA, Alex.
Oh, my pleasure. Thank you so much.
Alexis Puentes is better known as Alex Cuba. His new album, Agua del Pozo, is available from Caracol Records. Yeah, yeah, yeah. Latino USA was produced this week by Walter Morgan, Benjamin Jacob, Angela Maldonado, and Alex Avila. Our executive producer is Sean Collins. We had help this week from CBC Calgary and Cecilia Weissman. To listen to our podcasts, go to latinousa.org or look for us on iTunes. Our listener comment line is 800-535-5533. Our email address is lusa@npr.org. Production support for Latino USA comes from KUT Radio, the Center for Mexican American Studies, the University of Texas at Austin, and the William and Salome Scanlon Foundation of Austin and San Antonio. I'm Maria Hinojosa. Join us again next week for NPR's Latino USA.
Support for NPR is provided by the Annenberg Foundation, advancing public well-being through improved communication, on the web at annenbergfoundation.org. By Anne and John Herman, supporting City Year and the young adults who dedicate a year of their lives to community service and leadership development. CityYear.org. And Lumber Liquidators, hardwood, bamboo, and cork flooring. Catalog at 1-800-FLOORING. This is NPR, National Public Radio.